broke in.
Hang on.
You're tuned in to the Nature's Talk Show. www.naturestalkshow.com.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Nature's Talk Show. This is Ken McKeon, welcoming you to the fine art of paleontology tonight, along with my co-host Ken Borman, and we have a super special guest joining us tonight here. But before we join him, I do want to invite all of our listeners to please check out Nature's Talk Show website. You can go there tonight, right now, while we're live on the air. You can click into our live chat room. And you can go in there, and you can talk back or chat back and forth about the show and the subject and everything. Or you can even field questions for our guest and or myself or Ken. And so please do that there and enjoy. And without further delay, we're going to say hello to Ken here real quick. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ken. And I'm sitting in the chat room now, waiting to talk to some people.
All righty.
Please sign on and come in and have a chat with me.
All right. We'll say a quick hi out to one of our first people that joined in our chat room is a nice young lady named Sarah. So we hope she's listening to us again tonight. So we have, once again, a very, very special guest that we are just absolutely thrilled to have back with us. Someone that I know, when you hear him talk, you can feel the passion in his voice. Just you can see the gleaming eyes and the little kid's rosy cheeks as he talks about his favorite subject. So we have with us Paleo Joe. Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
Not bad. You are crazy. You know that? That is unbelievable. Yeah, I'm having a great time.
Yeah. So, yeah, today was here in New Mexico. We've been having some great weather. Here we'll do a. What was kind of fun is I was able to get out in the field today, and we was able to do a little bit of a saline age Lower Permian research today.
I'm really jealous because we still got snow here. We're we're I don't know, maybe got 2-3 inches left. It's starting to melt. We've had a couple days of 40 and 50 degree weather, which is really nice and warm for Michigan this time of year. But
yeah.
I can't wait to get out into the field. I've got a lot of stuff planned for this summer. Going to be doing a lot of field work this year.
Sweet. Yeah, we're out here. We're going to be doing a lot ourselves. I did a lot of artwork last year, and I'm planning to work in the Permian. So it's been a lot of fun. And one of the cool things today, my daughter, she goes out in the field with me, and she found her first Permian bone site today.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's kind of fun.
This year it's going to be pretty much for me. I'm going to be doing a lot more trilobite work. I've got my trilobite exhibit is actually opening in Evansville, Indiana, here in May. And that exhibit from there is from Evansville is going down to Tennessee and then over to North Carolina. So really pleased with that exhibit. I've got a couple more components I'm putting together, but it's a real world class exhibit. So I need to go, dig up some more bugs. I love my bugs. and then I'm going to try to get a lot more dinosaur digging in this year. I'm really excited to go back to Hanksville burpee site. That place is out in south central Utah. And we're getting a lot of really great dinosaurs out of there. There's a paleontologist by the name of Mike Demick who's doing a lot of research now on the bone histology. And what they're trying to do is they're doing thin sections, trying to find out how quickly they grew. By looking at the bones, you can see, if they grew quickly, slowly, how old they were. They're doing lots and lots of bone histology work right now, which is kind of exciting because, what we're finding is lots of juveniles, lots of subadults in that one area. We're not finding a lot of adults. So it's kind of an interesting thing going on at Hanksville.
Wow, that is fascinating. What age is that?
That's about 155 million years old. It's a Jurassic site. It's a nice-looking Jurassic site. It's been known for quite a while to the locals, but they just called us up a couple years ago and had a guy from the Burpee Museum of Natural History went out there and took a look, and when he walked out there, he was absolutely flabbergasted by the amount of bone material just laying on the ground. Nobody had really done any work out there since, decades and decades ago. So when we got there, there was just float everywhere, and we started digging. No matter where we dug, we hit a bone. and it's just a massive bone pile. We figure we've got probably about 11 sauropods coming out of there. You know, you take the femurs, you know, divide up the femurs, and it tells you how many dinosaurs you got. So we're doing really well out there. Last year, they found the scutes of an ankylosaur. And Jurassic ankylosaurs are kind of pretty rare. You don't see them that often. And we found a bunch of scutes there. Last year, we also found a very small theropod. Don't really know what it is yet. They're still, you know, digging the bones out and prepping them and looking at them. But it's a small theropod out there as well. So really, really a wonderful, wonderful dinosaur site.
Fantastic. That's one of the places I really wish I could get a chance to go to. Is I have never had the opportunity to go to Utah. And... But then now,
you're so close.
I know. How dare I? You know.
That's how I feel about it sometimes. Oh yeah, it's tough to get in the car and travel. You know, I mean, this year, you know, I'm going to be right around the corner from you, and I still can't come and visit you this year. I really do want to get out there to the Triassic site and the Permian site and look around, because I've never done Triassic or Permian, so I'd really love to get out there. But this year is so full. When I go digging in Hanksville, just before that, I'm going to go up to Kemmerer again and dig at the Warfield Quarry and get a bunch more fish. I got wonderful fish last year.
Wow.
From Kemmerer, I'm going to go down to Hanksville and do the dig down there, and I'm going to fly back home. I got some stuff to do. And then later on in the summer, I'm going back out to Kemmerer, and I'm filming the second show, the second episode of my Fossils Across America. The first show is out. It's the Silurian Trilobites of the Rochester Shale. I had a really great following of that video. That's a DVD documentary. And my second one is going to be on the Green River. And when we finish shooting that one, we're going to drive down to Delta, Utah, not that far away, maybe about 4 or 5 hours, and we're going to do a show on the U-Dig Fossil Quarry, where you get lots and lots of trilobites, mostly the Elrithias and Asafiscus. But we're going to film two shows, and then once we get back to Michigan, we're going to do the editing of those shows and hopefully get them out on video sometime this year. So lots of great documentary work we're doing as well.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah,
I got a suggestion for one. I'll do one on Dimetrodon.
Well, you know, if you got a site, if you got the time, I'd love to come down and do one there as well. It works. It works.
Well, have you heard about the latest New Mexico Dimetrodon find?
Yeah, I've been kind of watching your Facebook posts, listening and watching.
It's
interesting, kind of exciting.
It is. I always, when I was a 10-year-old kid, and I found my first fossil, you know, I always dreamed of what it would be like to find something that would be new to science, you know, and shake up the thinking. And now we're having to rethink our paleontology of the Permian here with a giant Dimetrodon back in the Acalian, because the big ones didn't really appear until, the Lenardian. So... fun stuff. That's what's fun about being a paleontologist, isn't it, Joe? Just being able to...
Absolutely.
Now, what kind of new trilobite stuff are you working on? Oh, well, go ahead, please.
I kind of thought I heard Ken in there. Were you trying to say something, Ken?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ken.
That's all right. Doesn't matter. I was just wondering, Joe, I know you've got a big year lined up ahead with all your digs and your documentary making, but I believe in the immediate future you've got you're doing some work with kids. Could you outline that
for our listeners, please? Well, it's really exciting. Here in Michigan, and I think across parts of the United States, March is Literacy Month. And that's where schools and libraries and organizations try to get kids to get out and read. A lot of kids nowadays, they'll sit at home and play in my day it was Nintendo, but they play Xbox and all these games, and we're trying to get kids to get out there and read. Because as they go through school, they have to do research, they have to read, even reading on the computer, they got to know how to read. So I've partnered with a couple of groups and organizations this year, and it's really exciting. Are you ready to hear about it?
Sure am.
The first one is United Financial Credit Union. United Financial Credit Union is a fairly local-based credit union in Saginaw, Michigan. And what we're doing is we've set up a display case of dinosaur bones over there. And I'm going to be doing a dinosaur a dinosaur day for the kids there. But what they do is when they come into the bank, kids can open a bank account with as little as 25 cents. if they open a bank account there and start their process of saving for their life, they will get a free copy of one of my books, The Disappearance of Dinosaur Sue. So the kids get a chance to, you know, start their bank accounts, get started on their future, and get a book that they can read as soon as they get it. The other people I've partnered with, this is kind of interesting. It's kind of surreal. The Saginaw Chippewa Indians have a casino about 20 miles away, and there's a really nice water park there. And this year for spring break, they're doing something they call, oh my gosh, I can't remember the name of it now, it's a dino blast. And basically what I'm going to be doing is going over to the water park and providing programs for kids and having my books there. And I've also got some bone displays there as well. The whole concept behind that is to give kids something to do when they're at the water park. I mean, you can only stay in the water so long. So they're having educational programming for kids, you know, and I'm going to be doing programs throughout the day. They go in, they go swimming, they have a good time, they come out, they have lunch, then they'll come and see me, and I'll do a dinosaur program. Talk to them about, you know, the different kind of dinosaurs we find, what they do, how they lived, how they ate, all that kind of cool stuff. Then they can go back and go swimming or go take a nap and come back out, and then I'll read from one of my books. We'll actually do a reading. It's my hidden dinosaur book I'm going to be reading to the kids. Then they go back and do whatever they want to do, and then they come back again, and I'll do another program for the kids. And this goes on from noon till 6, the days that I'm there. So really, it's in conjunction with these two organizations. I'm doing lots of reading programs for kids, and I really enjoy it. I really love it because, again, we're challenging the kids to get out there and read. We're also challenging the kids to get out there and think a little bit.
Wow, that's excellent. I wish I was closer. I'd come and check you out myself.
Yeah. Well, you're not that far away. You're only down in Chatham, right?
Yeah, I'm in the next state to you. I'll get there one day.
All right.
You'll get a knock on your door and it'll be me.
You got it. I'm looking forward to it.
I believe you've also got something lined up with the Detroit Zoo.
Gosh, you know, you've been watching my Facebook, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I must admit.
All right. Well, with
and
the Detroit Zoo,
website. We must mention that, too.
Yeah, well, with the Detroit Zoo, what I'm doing is this year they've got something they call Dinosauria. It's a company that actually has animatronic dinosaurs that, you know, move around and raise their head and turn from side to side. They don't do any walking, and they're just kind of stationary, but they move back and forth. They've got 42 dinosaurs that are going to be on a trail at the Detroit Zoo. And it's kind of a really nice wooded trail, kind of looks like a jungle, so it kind of fits. And at the end of the trail, there's a building. They put up a little mock dig site where the kids can dig in the dirt and find some, plaster fossils and things like that. But I'm also going to set up a table there, and I'm going to be doing dinosaur bone cleaning demonstrations. So as the people walk by, they can come by and sit there and talk to me and say, hey, you know, what are you doing and why are you doing that? If you go to a place like the Field Museum in Chicago, they do have a paleontologist working behind glass, but they're behind glass. You can't talk to them. You can't interact with them. Here at the Detroit Zoo, they can walk right up to me and say, hey, you know, what's that tool you got? What are you doing? Why are you doing that? So I can actually interact with the public as I'm cleaning dinosaur bones. And then throughout the day, I'll be there leading tours through the exhibit, telling them about different dinosaurs, what we think about them, what we believe the dinosaurs were like as they're, you know, roaring and doing their thing, their animatronic thing. So that's another cool thing that I'm doing. Gosh, they got me keeping pretty busy this summer.
That's a very busy summer schedule ahead of you, what with all your digging and your work with the kids and at the zoo.
I try to get out and dig as much as possible. In May, I'm going to be in Buffalo, New York. Buffalo, there's a dig site there. It's the Penn Dixie Outdoor Education Center. And if you're anywhere near New York, and I don't know where all your listeners are from, maybe they can, you know, get on your website and kind of tell us where they're from. If they're anywhere in the Buffalo area or western New York area, there's a great site called the Penn Dixie Outdoor Education Center. If they want to look at it on the web, it's PennDixie.org, PennDixie.org. And you can actually go there and you can dig trilobites. You get to keep what you find. And every year around Mother's Day, and I think this year it's May 15th or 16th, I'm not sure, I have to look at my calendar, we're going to be actually doing a dig out there as well. The day before, I'm giving a lecture that evening on Utah dinosaurs. And then that Saturday, we're actually going to be out in the field digging trilobites. You get to keep all the trilobites you find. So there, again, is another educational opportunity for people to come and see and hear what dinosaurs were like. Although there are no dinosaurs in in New York, we still will be talking about some dinosaurs as we go out and dig for trilobites.
Wow.
Wow. What do you think of that, Ken?
You know what, Ken, you and I are going to have to go and join Joe here with on that. You know what?
Oh,
you know, because the things that's what I love about talking with fellow paleontologists, you know, and hearing all the fun things we're doing, you know, and since I've switched over to vertebrate paleontology, I don't get to go out as often as I'd like to work with invertebrates. Now, but one of these days I want to hit the Cambrian out here. We have an upper Cambrian deposit here in southern New Mexico that has some interesting trilobites in it.
Yeah, the Cambrian is really a great period. It's been the gold mine for trilobites, because the Cambrian was listed as the age of trilobites. The most trilobites we've found, families, genus, and species came out of the Cambrian. It was literally the explosion. Cambrian explosion was just loaded with trilobites.
Yeah,
Is it the same kind of deposits over in Utah, or is it a little bit different? Different in age.
Well, the ones in Utah are upper and middle Cambrian. The deposits we have are basically near shore sandstones. And it appears to be conformable at the Ordovician, because in the lower part, and doggone it, I cannot think of the name of that formation, but you're going to have to come out one day. When you come to New Mexico, you're going to make several trips.
I know.
You know, just.
I still want to get out to Tucson and do the Rock and Mineral show out in Tucson and see. I've never been to Tucson to that show, so I'm kind of excited to get out there and do that. And yeah, Tucson's not that far away from you guys either.
Yeah, for me, I think whip out the I-40 and I could be there in just a matter of a few hours. And maybe if you're going to be there, I'll just have to sit there and say, you know what, I'm going to take a weekend and go there too, and we'll just hook up there.
Absolutely. Well, the hard part is, you know, again, you can see from my schedule how busy it is, but we need to get out there.
Yeah, well, that's it. I understand. Like I said, this year here too, we're trying to schedule in as many field trips as we can, because with the discovery of the new Dimetrodon here, you know, I want to start working really heavily the Abbo Formation, and also I want to work back into the Bursum Formation, which is the lower and middle Salian. Because I think that's where we're going to start seeing the earliest Dimetrodon divergence, and it's going to be here in the Southwest. You know, here in not Texas, but here in I believe the Zuni Defiance. We work that, and we're going to find the oldest Dimetrodons, and they evolved at the same time Sunacadon did on the Uncompahgre uplift. I think we'll find that, and we'll see the same similar animal that led to both of them. But it's going to be a lower Salian specimen. I think that's where we'll find it finally.
Nice. It's great that you've got some competition with Texas now, you know, because Texas has been a place where they found lots and lots of Dimetrodon as well. So it's nice that you've got some good stuff there as well.
It's real exciting, you know. It fell into my lap.
Yeah.
Oh man, and you can't beat that now, a paleontologist. That's for sure.
Yep. Who's you got anybody helping you do the research on that?
Actually, my brother and my daughter go out with me in the field. My brother, he's a volunteer researcher, field researcher at the museum. He never got published, so he wasn't able to get a full research associate appointment because I'd been published and studied geology, you know, stuff like that. I was lucky. So I... Got the full research associate appointment, you know, which is awesome, because when I think of the people I'm up there with research, you know, the research associates around the different museums, it's like, wow, I must have a pretty darn good eye.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really exciting, but they're helping me. And
I'm sorry?
Oh, I was just catching the other Ken. What's he doing in nice cold Canada right now?
It's just starting to warm up here. We're a little bit south of you, so it's a little bit warmer for me. And I'm thinking about heading up to Arcana soon to see what what's being washed out.
That's going to be a nice sight. Yeah, Arcona is wonderful. I haven't been over there in the last couple of years, but, boy, I still love the Arcona deposits. There's a couple of guys down in Detroit that have done a lot of study and research, and actually they won this year's Catherine Palmer Award from the Paleontological Research Institute for the work that they've done on the Arcona Formation, the Hungry Hollow Formation. They've got one of the premier collections of Arcona material. They've come up with some starfish. They've got all kinds of trilobites, crinoids. It's just a tremendous, tremendous collection they have. And it's the Toper brothers, and they are they're great. I mean, they've got to know the people that own the sites. They've got great access to the sites. And they've just done some tremendous research. Again, it's one of the things I'd like to get up there and do, but I got to find the time. Maybe we
can set up
a trip. You and I can go to Arcona ourselves together.
Yeah, actually, I'm only 2 hours from there, and you wouldn't be much
That's
more
That's not bad. And actually, I'm not much further. It's 45 minutes for me to get to Flint and 45 to get to Sarnia. So really, about an hour and a half, I'll be in Arcona.
An
hour and a half. 2 hours, I'll be in Arcona. Yeah,
about the same then, really, I guess. Close enough, anyway.
Hmm.
Well.
You know what might be fun when I'm there for that convention? Wasn't that where you was planning on running me down to, Ken?
Yep.
Well, shoot, Joe, there in May, if you got a free day, we can all hook together there.
Do you know when in May?
We haven't decided when Ken's coming yet. If he's coming before the convention to spend some time with us, or spend some time after
the
convention.
Yeah, I should probably spend maybe a day or so after, because I don't have anything, really scheduled. Then we can run down there and do that, and have a nice free day.
Mm-hmm.
When is
the fish convention? Ken's speaking at it. It's the Canadian long weekend. The weekend before your long weekend in the States.
Oh, okay. Ours is Labor Day weekend, so it would be
the weekend
before Labor Day.
The 18th. Then I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be in Buffalo doing my programming over in Buffalo. That's not that far. It's about 3 hours, but no, I can't make it there that day.
Oh, man. I'm going to be doing a talk on the evolution of the fishes. Freshwater fishes. So
nice.
Yeah, lots of photographs, the fossils and stuff going to be in it, and lots of good hard evidence and everything. So it's going to be a really cool talk. And
one of the things I'd like to get you to do is come up here to Michigan and look at some of our Devonian fish that we've got. We've got a great example of Devonian fish up in Alpena, Michigan. Every time I go up to a quarry up there, I find a hunk of fish. Placoderms, that's the kind of
thing.
And actually, I was just looking recently on Facebook. Somebody had posted a picture of a chimera, and it was a really clear picture of the chimera, and it looked like it had the same type of cephalic shields that the placoderms had. I mean, they say they're not, obviously, but boy, that sucker looked a lot like a placoderm.
You know what's really cool about the chimeras, though? They are the oldest of the fishes on the planet. They are the oldest, so they're right there at that evolutionary changeover from the placoderm lineage.
They have a very, very similar appearance.
Yeah, but that's really funny. When I was doing my research for my, when I first did the evolution of fishes at the NEC conference in Connecticut last year, I checked into, the chimeras and stuff and found out that they're evolutionary are the oldest fishes on the planet right now. Except for of course, the anathids.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, it is. I love that. He's like, man, I want a chimera. Dang it.
Yeah. But the picture, I think, came from NOAA. They've got that sub that goes down and does their research and does their photograph work, and they just got this beautiful picture of that chimera. And it, like I said, it looked really similar to a placoderm. So, never know. You never know what's in those deep oceans.
You know, one of my favorite animals found is, are you familiar with the, is it the lantern sharks, I think it is?
No.
These guys are a tiny, tiny shark. They're the smallest sharks in the sea. I think I think they're the lantern sharks because they have like illuminary eyes that glow or real reflective. But they only get just a few inches long, around 8 to 10 centimeters long. You know, and but they're little sharks. And they're really primitive. They have the doubled dorsal with the two spikes, you know, like the you know, early sharks. And but they're really, really a fascinating group of sharks. But they're deep sea, and I always thought it'd be fascinating to be able to, you know, study those in you know, an aquarium. But they live too deep, and I think everyone that's brought to the surface died. But they're just a small shark. They, you know, just inches long. Nothing like you think when you think of the great white, you know.
Right, right. Nice.
Oh, we got a discovery, Joe, that you got to come. When you come into New Mexico, when we got you come out here, we're going to go to the Museum of Natural History. One of the big discoveries New Mexico had in the last couple of years is they found a 3-meter-long hypodont shark that's complete. Everything's there. It's the most complete shark fossil ever found, and it come from the Kenny Quarry over here on the just above the Manzanita Mountains, just east of me here.
Wow, nice.
Oh, it's got everything's in it. Even, I mean, it is. It was such a fascinating way that it fossilized. It was in a brackish water estuary in an anoxic zone, and before it broke apart, you know how most shark fossils do. So we've got the almost complete skeleton, components that you would not see there or believe were preserved on this fossil. So for all our shark lovers out there, you know, you it's amazing.
Yeah. Is it fully prepped out already? Did they put it on display yet?
They're getting it ready. They're doing a lot of prep work on it. It's, like I said, it's amazing. You know, the complete, you know. Well, it's really cool when you look at the fins. The dorsal spine on the front dorsal is almost a meter long.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, no. It's amazing when you look at that, you know. And then, of course, one of my favorite parts that I was checking out was when you look at the tail. And, you know, you've got all the cartilaginous supports. I forget what that's called now. It's mine. But, you know, the tail's there. I mean, you can see the body, the scales, all the squamation there, you know, that helps helps you see the outline of the body. It's a beautiful preserved specimen.
Wow. I've got a young person who's probably tuned in today from here in Michigan who's really interested in paleontology. To hear it from someone else, not from me, can you talk a little bit about what it takes to become a paleontologist or geologist? How you went to school, what you did to get the degree?
Well, believe it or not, I'm considered an amateur, okay? I don't have a degree in paleontology.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you know, there's a lot out there.
I studied geology at Ball State University. But, well, this is how I became a paleontologist, working for a museum. And it's a lot of work. You know, you really, 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 really got to prove yourself when you are an amateur, you know. And I actually did. But what I did is I started out when I was very young, studying fossils, studying rocks, reading everything I could get a hold of as a kid. This starting at 10 years old. And I started, like your books, Joe, I would have had every one of them when I was a kid, you know, if you'd been published then, you know, so... But I read everything I could. And one of the things I did is I read textbooks. I would get college textbooks. This was started in high school, and I still do it. And I read textbooks, you know, to keep up to date with the science that they're teaching. But now, but field work. Now, here's something that I recommend. Here's the trouble with being a paleontologist, too. It's a tough thing to break into. Dr. Lucas was telling some young people about how tough it is. You know, said you really want to be one first, because you know there's a limited number of jobs. But what I did is not only did I study paleontology, but I also studied ichthyology, and I had a passion for ichthyology. So I started writing articles and papers on fish. Believe it or not, papers on the captive maintenance of pupfish, captive maintenance of different types of killifishes. I did a whole lot of work with killifishes over the years, so I'm well known as that. And but I was published in a lot of journals. I'd send my papers and stuff and things into a lot of different publications around the world. Actually, I've been published in Japan, Germany, Great Britain with these articles, you know. So, but you got to be published to be put on a research staff. That's one of the things that really, really helped me becoming a field researcher for the museum. If I hadn't been published, they said, like my brother, he'd never published anything, so he is basically a volunteer. So he doesn't have the status of being a field researcher. You know, he doesn't get to write as many papers. He doesn't get, you know, just, the fun of being a research associate with the museum. But you got to really work at it. You got to study, and get good at it. You know, don't be misled by failed fossil stuff. Just get really, and study the rocks, read. Field work. Can I say stress field work enough, Joe?
Yeah.
Oh, you can't stress field work enough. I mean, I studied all the bioherbs across central Indiana when I was cutting my teeth in my 20s. You know, I studied the Silurian rocks there, and I went to every stone quarry that had an exposed bioherb. I went to it, you know, to study it. And I studied the Waldron Shale, too, and I wanted to see the extent of the Waldron Shale throughout central Indiana. So you got to study. You got to go to these places. You got to ask permission. Now, it's another thing, too, to be a good paleontologist, is you need to be a friendly person to people, because a lot of our research is conducted on private land. And if the landowners don't like you, you aren't going to get on their property.
Yeah.
And so you got to cultivate that. You know, there's so.
That's a great thing you bring up, that not everybody is a professional paleontologist, or at least gets a degree in paleontology, because there is so much work to do in paleontology that there's just not enough people to do it. And many, many people are out there doing the work, and they're not quote unquote school trained. I myself also am not school trained. And many, many paleontologists are like that. There's a huge demand in the field, and mm-hmm. not enough people to fill that demand. So yeah, it's an interesting job, interesting life. But you're right. The reading part of it, and that's kind of why we're stressing, you know, the read right now. But you got to do the work. You got to work hard.
Yeah, and for me, see, I like doing it, so it's not work to me. Every time I read a paper or something, you know, to me it's I don't know. I just consider it's like reading a comic book to some people, I guess, you know, when I'm reading this, except, you know, I'm learning about my planet. And this is what's really cool, though. If you study really hard and you get out there and you learn really hard. Now, I got to upstage a professional paleontologist geologist. I got the. This is funny. This is one of the ways I became a field researcher, too. We started taking in what we thought were fossils to the Museum of Natural History. Got a real quick lesson in collecting, you know, difference between bone fossils and steinkerns. Bone, for the most part, will never form a steinkern. It fossilizes bone. And we found that out. And we started finding bone there at the museum, you know. We started getting this lesson. Now, what was really funny, when we started getting permission down in the Abel Pass to start collecting in the Permian there, there was this place called the Shirley Copper Mine. It's been known for over 100 years, since the 1914s. They started mining it for copper at the open pit copper mine. They sunk some shafts, and it was known for its fossil plants, its copperized fossil plants. A lot of calamities and stuff. So my brother and I found out, I got permission from the owner. So we went out there to go and collect. Well, the first time we got to collect at this really magnificent place, this copper mine, it was really cool. So as we were walking around the place, we come back around and we find this fossil, and we look at it at first, and it's like, we didn't realize the fossil. We'd been finding a lot of calcite and stuff, and we figured it was just an odd-shaped formation with calcite. So we picked the rock up, took it back with us, and when we got back to where we'd parked at the copper mine, I noticed a little toe bone. Little bluish-colored fossilized toe bone. So when we took these two bones in, well, the first one in the big rock we took in turned out to be Dimetrodon, a Sacmarine Dimetrodon. My brother has the youngest Dimetrodon fossil here from New Mexico. But, so that's really cool. But what was really neat, I took that tailbone and I took it into Spencer Lucas, and that's when he signed me up because I'd been published and everything. We find this Dimetrodon. He wanted us on the staff because we're going to find this. That was the first fossil we found. He was Dimetrodon. Supposed to be the rare one. But he told me I couldn't put that tailbone in place because I found out he'd already been out to the Shelly Copper Mine. Everybody'd been there. Nobody found any bone there. And there's no way me, you know, was going to be able to put that little toe bone in place. And my brother, he said he saw me kind of stiffen up and look at Lucas. You know, my brother caught that, huh? You telling me I can't find where this bone goes? Whoa. You know, it's on. So we went back out to the Shelly Copper Mine. And as soon as we got there and parked, my brother wanted to go hunt some more copperized petrified wood. And I said, you go find your petrified wood. I'm going to find out where that bone come from. And I walked over to the open pit, and I got to looking around, and I started seeing fossil bone here, pieces of bone there. I couldn't believe it. And I started seeing bone in the rock, the sandstone just covered with bone, full of bone. And then the coupe de grace was there in this one little wall, was in situ, a piece, a round part, roundish piece of sandstone, had a femur sticking out of it. And I'm going, context. Now, what was fun, when I took that big rock in with the femur in and I showed it to Lucas, he goes, where'd you get that? I said, Shelly Copper Mine. He's like, kind of looked at me like, no way. So we went back to the Shelly Copper Mine. I started showing him all the bone in the rock, skulls and things like that. And this guy was almost in tears because he was telling the one lady went out with us, another field researcher, that he had been standing exactly where we were picking up bone up, and he did not see the bone. And he was not the only geologist or paleontologist that had been there. So 100 years of people going out there, and this amateur discovered the Shelly Copper Mine bone site. We found over 6 taxa, including Dimetrodon there. So,
wow.
So amateurs, you can do it.
Yep. And there is also the opportunity to become a professional at it. There's a young man I'm mentoring right now here in Michigan who's, that's his dream. That's what he's going to do with his life. And he's doing a really good job so far. But there again, he's working hard at it. He's reading. I think he's leaning more towards trilobites, which, you know, is going to make me very happy. But there are some paleontologists out there as well. But even if you think about some of the famous ones, Dr. Bakker, one of his doctorates is an honorary doctorate. If you think about Dr. Horner, his is also an honorary. So, you know, a lot of people doing a lot of work. You know, just because, and actually, we're not, the term amateur and professional are really, really crazy, because if you're doing the work, if you're getting paid to do work and you're working at it all the time, you are a professional, whether you have that degree behind your name or not, whether you've got that paleontology degree. Many people start off as geologists, and oddly enough, you know, you got to know the rocks that you're digging in before you can find the fossils. So you got to know, a lot of times you got to know the stratigraphy, you got to know the rocks, you got to know where the fossils come from. So, and that comes from the science of geology. So geology is critical. And a lot of people actually start in geology before they move on to paleontology.
Well, that's what I went to Ball State and took, you know, down in Muncie, Indiana. You know, I went to study geology because I said, you know what, to be a good paleontologist, I got to know what the rocks tell me. And, you know, what's fun about this, too, when you gain experience, Joe, when I'm walking out here through the Abbo now, and I can look, I can, from the road now, I can see where channel lags are crumbling apart, you know, just by the way the type of plants are growing on it and stuff. And when you start being able to see this, you know, this is where the experience comes in, and that's what makes you a good paleontologist, because then you can start targeting, you know, what you're looking for. And guess what we're doing? We're finding the bone there. We go right to it. And
and that's the thing. You can, after a while, you can see everything there.
For example, like the Silurian deposits in New York, the guys that are working Caleb's quarry, they've been working it now for 20 years. They walk into that quarry and say, well, that's the horizon over there where you find Dalmanites. This is the horizon where you find Arctinaris. You know, they know just by looking at the rock. And many times, you know, somebody will come by and they'll give me a piece of rock to identify at a show or at a one of the programs I'm doing. A lot of people bring lots of fossils to me to show. And I look at them, and I look at the fossil, and I say, see, you must have gotten this from such and such a location. How did you know that? Well, you know, just by looking at the rock, the texture of the rock, where the rock came from. Not always, but many times you can tell where this stuff came from just by looking at the rock and looking at the type of fossil. You know where it came from.
You know, that's really cool, because one of the things I was noticing here throughout the different bone sites we collect, every bone site's fossil bone is distinct. I can tell where every bone comes from all throughout the Permian here of New Mexico, just by looking at the fossil. I can say where it's Guyana Well, Shirley Copper Mine, Lucero Uplift, you know, or Hema Springs, because each site is distinct when it comes to its preservation, you know. We call the Shirley Copper Mine the Purdy Bone because a lot of it's got copper minerals in it. So you have blue, light bluish-gray bone, sometimes greenish bone, you know, so... it's our pretty bone, and the Lucero Uplift's our gray bone. A lot of it's grayish to blackish. And our bone we find down in the Guyana Well has a lot of purple and whitish in it, and a little bit of red. So it's our red bone.
Yep.
But it is neat.
I've got two questions from my daughter I wonder if you would mind answering.
Sure. Which one? You can.
Are there any more plans on doing any more Dinosaur Detective Club books? And?
I know you... Yep.
How are we going with the movies?
Well, good question. The books right now are on hold because we're waiting to see how the movie is going to go. They've decided to go animated movie. First of all, the reason we've been working on it for about 2 years now, you know, when you make Hollywood, when you go to Hollywood, and I don't know if the listeners know this, but there's a movie company that has approached me and optioned my books to make animated movies out of, and that's really exciting. It's been going on for about 2 years now, and what we've done is we've decided to go animated rather than live action because Shelley and Dakota, the two stars of the books, they're kids. And if you get live action, eventually these kids will grow up, especially if we've got a series that spans several years. The kids are going to grow up, and we want to make sure the kids stay the same age. So we've opted for animated movies. And right now we are getting the funding together. We're really close. All the contracts have been signed. We're just waiting for the funding. And as soon as the funding comes through, we've got an animation company is standing by ready to start animating the movie. We've got to go out and hire some people to do some voiceovers, and the movie will be coming out. So I'm really excited about it. Once the first one comes out, if it does well, then all the other books in my series will be made into animated movies, and then I need to start writing books. My original contract with the publisher was to write 15 books. We've only written 5. So that means I got another 10 books I got to come up with once this thing goes. So right now, the great question, you know, are there more books coming? And I get that question all the time. Not yet, because we're waiting to see how the movie thing goes. But if the movie thing goes, yep, I'm going to be writing lots and lots of books.
That's
so
great.
So thank you, daughter, for that question.
Yeah. And she will thank you, too, when you write them.
does she enjoy them?
Yeah, she does.
Can you tell me a little bit about what does she enjoy about them? What's the enjoyment of it?
Well, at one stage she wanted to be a paleontologist, but that's kind of no longer on the horizon. So that initially attracted her to them, but she just likes the stories.
That's
she
great.
Knows a lot
great.
About paleontology, so she can follow them very easily. But she just thinks they're well written.
Well, thank you.
So there you go. Reading fantasy now.
Well, I had a person who's helping me, not a ghostwriter, but an assistant, who actually co-author. You know, I'd write it, and then they would bring it a little bit closer to younger kids' level, because sometimes the jokes that I would tell, you know, the kids wouldn't get the jokes. So she took them and brought them down to a more of a understandable level for kids. She's actually a elementary school teacher, so she knew, you know, what kids like, what they don't like, you know, what they can understand, what they can't. So I'd write it, she'd rewrite it, and then we'd combine and write the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, as well, my daughter is getting older too, obviously. She's 12 now, so, and she's reading adult fantasy novels, so maybe
wonderful.
Maybe you could.
So is she going to go out to the? Does she go out to the field with you when you go digging?
She has done. Yep.
Wonderful. What does she
do? You know, it's
fun. She does.
It's fun when your kids go out with you.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is my kids don't. I used to drag them to the field all the time, so they wanted nothing to do with paleontology. So my kids do not do it. But one of my daughters is a psychologist, and the other one works in retail. But they decided long ago that Dad was dragging them to the field enough. They don't want to do that for a living.
It can be good. It's definitely different.
Yeah, it is different, and you know, I enjoy the outdoors. That's the good thing about it. You know, traveling across this country is something special. You know, I get a chance to see the United States from corner to corner, and the good thing about that is to see how special the country actually is. All the different terrain features, all the different parts of the country. You know, you drive through, you know, the Great Plains, and now you know why. When you go to school, everybody keeps talking about the Great Plains, what makes them so great? Well, drive through the Great Plains and see how beautiful they are. Same thing going up into the mountains. I mean, it's just it's a joy and it's a wonder to travel across the country, and I've been lucky and fortunate enough to travel across this country coast to coast in search of those crazy things called fossils.
Yeah, man, it is cool. You know what? One thing I like too when you travel across the country is as you're looking at the rocks, you know, and you see places, you know, where you can see where the ocean's covered, parts of the continent, you know, and you see where the land fossils are. I just like, you know, love seeing that, you know, the different biotypes, like, you know, that occurred then, that we see in the rocks. You know, as you said, when you're driving out across this, you know, across North America here, it's fantastic. You know, one of the things I like bragging about is I've been all the way from the Okefenokee Swamp to Death Valley, and I've seen killifish.
Yeah.
You know, and
you bring up a really great point. You know, I look now as I'm driving around. It drives my wife crazy sometimes. I'll say, "Oh, look, over there is this type of, you know, deposit. Over there is this. Oh, you know, another. You know, over there could be something like this." And that's an occupational hazard after a while, that you're just looking at the deposits. You're looking at the areas, and you can kind of tell what's going on where. And one thing here in Michigan that really gets me going is as we drive around, we see bogs and areas that used to be a lake at one time. You can tell it was a lake at one time. Now it's just a bog or dry land. I say, you know, there could be a mastodon in there. Again, you know, back then you'd had all these shallow lakes, and in the wintertime they'd freeze over like they've done this year, and you get a big mammoth or mastodon walking by, and they start going across the ice. They break through it and sink into it, and they die and sink to the bottom of the lake. And then over the last, you know, 15,000 years, that lake starts to slowly fill in. It turns into a bog. Then it turns into a field. And then you can see the ring of trees around, you know, where the bog used to be. And, you know, you can almost imagine that at the bottom of that area, there's a mastodon down there, you know. So those are kind of the interesting things that I like to look for as I drive around as well. But you're right to see the different eskers and moraines and things like that created by the ice ages, and you travel further down south. To your part of the country, you know, you've got the red rocks from the Triassic, and then they change, and you see the gray areas. And one thing I really look for a lot when I travel is I look for gray shale. That gray shale, a lot of times, is just loaded with fossils. If you were talking about the shale, the Waldron shale in Indiana. You know, as you're driving around Indiana, the Waldron shale has this unique color, And as you're driving through some of these cliffs and road cuts and things, you'll see that color, and you say, you know, I got to stop there because that's water and shale. And chances are, yeah, you're going to find stuff there. And that's the kind of thing that I do as well as I travel across the states. You know, I know the different types of formations, and I look for that color. I look for that texture. I look for that rock. And that's where you find them.
Yeah, that's like us now when we're looking, driving out across looking at red beds, you know, and picking out the different ones. And it's really cool when you look at the Permian because, see, when here in the New Mexico, we've got the lower part of the Permian. We have marine beds with it. There's like six cycles of transgression regression through here. So we got land, marine, land, marine, land, marine, you know. Then we get to the Abbo, and it turns into a floodplain that moves up into the Canyon de Espinosa, Sac Marion. It starts turning into a dry floodplain. Then we get back into the Yeso, which is younger yet, the Lenardian. Then we start getting the transgressions of the sea again. So we have sea and land and sea and land. And we've even found some of the other, last time we was out a few weeks ago, one of the people that went with us actually found a nautiloid fossil, coiled nautilus,
nice.
In the Permian rock. Yep. From one of the intrusions, you know, but it's in between those beds now. It's where we're looking for, you know, the tetrapods now. But then we hit the this other layer, and it's nothing but gypsum, and it showed a time here at this area. Now this is what's cool, Ken. When you see this big, massive, thick layer of gypsum, and realize that it was nothing but sabka, dry, hot water was probably hot. You know, very little life living in it because it's so hypersaline. You know. And it's amazing when you look at these rocks and you see all that, you know, and you can go, wow, that's what that represents. That was some rough times.
Yeah.
So there's one really
unique deposit that I found. No, go ahead, Ken.
I was just saying, so that's a good tip for all you youngsters listening into the show. Study your geology.
Absolutely. That's key. One really neat thing I found last year is up in Alpena. There's a great ice age site. There's a quarry that I was going into because they had a lot of Devonian rocks and Devonian limestones. But as they were cutting into the quarry, they had excavated this one section that had basically looked like a layer cake. The bottom section was this hard rock limestone. That limestone is 300 to 360 million years old. Right up above that layer of limestone is a layer about 2 feet thick of nice cream, or actually not a cream color, more of a reddish color sand. That's the kind of sand that kind of is all over the state of Michigan. Right above that is a layer of peat moss. Right above that is a layer of beautiful white marl. Right up above that is a layer of peat moss, and right above that is the topsoil. And what it is, it's an actual site where you can see as the last ice age left Michigan, you know, what happened is the lakes would transgress. We had let me back up a little bit. I'm sorry. I'm confusing everybody, and we only got a couple of minutes left. What happened was after the last ice age, the snow kind of retreated back up, and it filled in some of these depressions, and it created what we call here in Michigan Lake Nipissing. Lake Algonquin. And what happened is, as it transgressed, came across the state, you know, it brought in with it sand, and it deposited all the sand and silt. Well, then eventually that pulled back away, and it became dry land. Over time, trees took root, grass took root, and it started to grow. And then something happened, and all of a sudden, here comes the water again, 6,000 years later, transgressed back across Michigan, knocked down all those forests, and it was a lake bed. And we know that because I look in the marl, and I can find clams and snails and other creatures that lived in the water. Then that eventually, you know, backed away, evaporated out, and now you had more forests coming in and repopulating the area with a forest area. And up above that, we've got the modern-day topsoil. It's an absolutely beautiful layer cake through history from 15,000 years ago till today. And that is, I'm sorry, I'm kind of a geek, that is fascinating to actually see how beautiful it is and to see what our history was like. And that's just one small piece. That's only 15,000 years.
Yeah. You know what's funny? Is that it's interesting because we're going through a similar time period that at the end of the Carboniferous, beginning Permian, you know, this weather patterns and stuff, you know, And when we're looking at the end of the the base of the Permian like that, you know, we see the regression, and you see at the base of each of every limestone layer, there's a layer of gray shale, you know, representing the inland lake, you know, just in the margin of the seashore. Then you see the limestone come over it, and then usually immediately on top of the limestone, you'll see red beds. But then once again, when you see that next intrusion of the sea coming in, you'll see as it moves further inland, you'll see these gray beds of these lakes, and then the marine intrusion. You know, it's really cool to see that, you know, in the rocks and be able to say, wow, I understand that. Today, one of the spots we went to was just covered with little small pockets of limestone beds, and these were freshwater lakes. And pond deposits, along with these stream deposits here in the Abbo where we were working, you know. So, and I was walking around and I'm looking at it, and I'm going, man, to be back there 297 million years ago when these ponds were full of water, the stream over there had water running in it, you know, and to see what, you know, the animals that were running there, the plants and stuff, you know, just knowing, you know, what I'm looking at the rock and what it really would have looked like back then. It just, you know, it's almost... it's almost frustrating in a way.
You know, it's fascinating. It really is to really see what nature's all about. And I guess you got to kind of love nature and love the earth and love the rocks to actually be able to see that stuff. But, again, I kind of joked about it. I'm kind of like a geek or a nerd when it comes to that stuff. But I really am. I really do enjoy seeing the ancient history. And I guess it's because I love history. I love the past. You know, you look at these things and you try to imagine in your own mind what could have been here, you know, so many years ago. And I think that's part of the fascination that I have with paleontology. What was the earth like so long ago?
Yeah, that's me, you know, and I look at the fossil and I you know, just wonder what the colors were. I don't know whether you've seen some of the fish reproductions I've done from some of the prehistoric fishes, you know. And I've tried to use modern fishes, you know, because I believe in convergent evolution on many organisms, you know, and patterns, color patterns and everything. And I just, it's fun being an artist to be able to sit there and put down in color, you know, how I could imagine maybe what some of these fishes might have looked like, you know. So I guess I'm lucky there. I get to draw and paint, you know, to be able to do that.
You know, and that's kind of a good thing too. I'm looking at the clock here. We're getting close. I really do enjoy when somebody is a decent paleo artist. I had a kid in one of my programs. He was a 12th grader, and you know, I'm talking about, you know, all the jobs that paleontologists can do, that you can do in the field of paleontology, paleogeneticist, paleobotanist, paleoceanographer. And the one kid said, you know, I want to be an artist. Is there a job for me in paleontology? And I said, oh my gosh, yes. Who do you think, you know, draws all these things for us? We need people that have these skills that can draw. Because when you're on a dig site and the dig site covers a football field, you can't get up high enough to take a picture of that dig site. And we like to record everything we find, the position of the bones, where they are, how they lay, what direction they lay in. And the only way you can do that is by getting a paleo artist with a grid and actually drawing it on a piece of grid paper, then going back to the university or museum and feeding all that into a computer to provide a dig site map for you. Only paleo artists can do that. So, yes, there's a job for paleo artists, and I love to see people who have that skill. I, unfortunately, don't. My artist skills are almost like stick figures, but I do the best I can. But, yes, if you have any kind of artistic talent at all, you're definitely needed in the field of paleontology as well.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a great field, you know. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff to do with paleontology. There's a lot of companies... industry, oil industry needs paleontologists, you know, they need micropaleontologists. You know, that's one field that, to me, I don't think I could sit, I love looking at my microscope through it and stuff, you know, but to have a job of going, counting conodonts and stuff, I think, I don't know where I could do that or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody's got to go out and find those fossil fuels for us, you know, so I guess somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, so there's all kinds, like I said, there's all kinds of stuff for a paleontologist. You know, Joe, I have never regretted studying since I was 10 years old. I'm 60 now. 50 years of my life, I've studied fossils, and it's been, you know, one of the most fascinating things of my life to be able to understand the Earth's past and to be able to marvel, you know, at it.
Exactly, I feel the same way.
Yeah. Well,
We're going to let you go, Joe, unless you want you have some things you want to wrap up here real quick?
No, I'm just, if people are interested in some of the things that I do, just go to my website, paleojoe.com, and you'll see a lot of different things that I do. I also have a Facebook page. If you want to friend me, I'll friend you back. My fan page, I don't use my fan page very often. I do post things there from time to time, but almost everything that I do on my friends page. But you can see kind of the different things that I do and where I'm going to be and what I'm going to be doing, so you can kind of stop by if you're in the area.
Fantastic. Now, we would like you to share links onto our Nature's Talk Show webpage, too, if you would, please, Joe, so people can hook up with that and everything. And we want to wish you luck in the field, everything. And I'm really, really looking forward to when you get to come out here to New Mexico and I can take you Dimetrodon hunting.
I can't wait. Take care, Ken. Take care, Ken. You guys have
fun. Take care.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi.
All right. Fantastic.
Well, it was just a reminder that if you go to www.paleojoe.com, you have a look around there. It's a huge site. There's lots of stuff to learn there. And that's where you can pick up his DVDs, the Silurian Trilobites of the Rochester Shale. It's 29 minutes long. It's nice and compact, and it's only $15 from him, and that includes the shipping in the lower continental U.S. So I'm sure if you asked him, he'd sign up for you, too.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Check it out. He's got all his books listed there, too. You can pick up his books from him, too, and I'm sure that he'll sign them for you, too, if anyone's interested.
You know, it's going to be fun when you and I get to hook up with Paleo Joe and go collecting with him, isn't it?
It will be, actually. Actually, I'm embarrassed. I am only literally 3 or 4 hours away from him, and I haven't been to see him.
Well, I bet you'll change that here soon.
Yeah. The trouble is there's a border in the way.
Yeah, I remember when that border didn't matter. You know it?
Well, it doesn't Australian.
All right. Well, we got some announcements here. You with us, Mary?
I'm right here.
Isn't Joe so cool?
What a great show it is with Paleo Joe on here all the time.
I love it that he's working with the kids.
Oh, me too. You know, kids are one of my passions in life. It's children, so.
Yeah.
So, I love it.
Yeah. That's really kind of fun, too, because I'm starting to work with the youth here in New Mexico. I'm signing up with the scouts to be a help them get their geology merit badges. So they'll have a real scientist working with them there. So
that'll
be fun.
I love that.
Yeah. So, at any rate, let's see here. We got a few show announcements here. And let's see. Let me get my thoughts together here. Oh, here we are. Coming up here on the 14th, we have the Killifish Hour with Chris Weatherford and myself. Now, we got a really good little fish we're going to talk about, Nothobranchus guntheri, or Gunther's Fire Killie. This is going to be for the beginning killiophile. So all of you out there that wish to work with these killifishes and you want to work with an annual killifish, tune in for that show, and I'll tell you all about it. Coming up on the 15th is the Nano Reef Hour with Albert J. Thiel and Joe Fossil, so you want to tune in for that one. Next Monday on the Fine Art of Paleontology, Ken and I are going to be talking about the evolution of bivalves, and we may have Mike Sanchez from the Museum of Natural History joining us, Mike.
That would be great.
Well, he's got some new information on the evolution of bivalves that I really want him to bring on, talk about. So I'm really, I want to get a hold of him and make sure he can join us for that one there. Coming up on the 17th, we have Monsters of Nature with Ray Serzik, and I'll be joining Ray with that as well. Coming up on the 20th, we have Biotypes with Ray Serzik and myself. Coming up on the 21st, we have Let's Talk Cichlids with Greg Steeves, so tune in for that show there. That's going to be a fun one. Nano Reef Hour on the 22nd with Albert J. Thiel and Joe Fossil, so that's going to be another one. Coming up on the 23rd, we got so many shows here, I just got to announce them. And so many cool ones, you know. Coming up on the 23rd, we have the return of Dr. Spencer Lucas from the New Mexico Museum of Natural History, the head curator.
and we're going to be talking about the Cambrian Ordovician systems. So that'll be a fun show. Coming up on the 25th, we have Greg Berard, and he's going to be joining, having a special guest join him on the Nautilus Files. So we're real excited about having the Nautilus Files coming back. Coming up on the 27th, your two of your funnest hosts, Ken Borman and Ken McKeon. Well, we will once again do the green scene. We're going, Ken and I are going to be talking about the club bosses. So that's going to be a fun show, huh, Ken?
It will be. I'm looking forward to that one, actually. It's a topic that I really am interested in.
Yeah. You know, we let our listeners out there, you know that you and I are the sexiest hosts here on Blog Talk, you know.
Of course we are.
Don't laugh at us.
I'm
laughing in a good way, all right.
Okay. Coming up on the 28th, we have the Herptile Hour with Chris Redford and myself here. We're going to talk about anacondas on that one there. The Nano Reef Hour on the 29th with Joe Foslow and Albert J. Thiel. And on the 30th on the Fine Art Paleontology, Ken and I are going to talk about the crustaceans. We haven't talked crustaceans yet, so that's going to be a fun show. And that's a full lineup, guys. For the rest of the month here.
Well, I just want to remind everyone what an amazing website we have, naturestalkshow.com. Go there, and we have a store now. You can go in there and order a mug, a T-shirt. I just ordered I'm getting ready to order my pajamas this evening. So very cool things. Tom has a mug already, I believe, don't you, Tom? And Timmy and I, we're getting our mug sometime before the end of the week, so I'm looking forward to it. They're great mugs, and Tom loves his. He drinks out of it all the time. So check that out. And it's really cool stuff there. There's T-shirts, mugs, water bottles, just about anything you want you can order from there. Support the show in that manner. And you can also donate to Nature's Talk Show on the website. All proceeds that we receive from there go straight into the show. Every penny of it goes back to the show. So check that feature out. And we are currently seeking advertisers. If you are interested in advertising on an amazing talk show where it's being seen all around the world, please contact Tom. Tom will send you out rates and everything. So just send Tom an email at tom@naturestalkshow.com, and he will get back to you as soon as possible. And the chat room is live, and you can leave messages in the chat room all day long if you want. We are in there. We will answer them or get them to who you can get your answers from. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, naturestalkshow.com on Twitter, and Blog Talk Radio. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/naturestalkshow, and there you are. Click on the follow button, and you're right there with us, and you'll be sent reminders every time we do the show. So that's all I have to say. I want to thank Ken Borman, Ken McKeon, Tom, my partner and part owner of Nature's Talk Show. Thank you, Tom, for being here and doing the studio for me. And all of the listeners around the world, and more importantly, Paleo Joe, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come here this evening. That's all I have to say for tonight, and good night, everyone, and be safe.
All right, thank you very much, Mary. And once again, thanking our guests and thanking my co-host here, Ken. And with that, I want to wish all of our listeners a wonderful evening as well, and join us here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Good night, everybody.
Good night from me.